This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details. Now we enlighten you with verses 162 to 165 of chapter Al-An'am from the Holy Quran, recited by Murtaza Fatimi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Qul inna salati wa nusuki wa mahyaya wa mamati lillahi rabbil alameen la sharika lah wa bithalika umirtu wa ana awalul muslimin qul aghayra Allahi abghi rabban wa huwa rabbu kulli shay'in ولا تكسب كل نفس إلا عليها ولا تزر وازرة وزر أخرى ثم إلى ربكم مرجعكم فينبئكم
In the name of God, the Compassionate, the Merciful. Say, surely my prayer and my sacrifice and my life and my death are all for Allah, the Lord of the worlds. No associate has He, and this am I commanded, and I am the first of those who submit. Say, what shall I seek, a Lord other than Allah? And He is the Lord of all things. And no soul earns evil but against itself, and no bearer of burden shall bear the burden of another. Then to your Lord is your return, so He will inform you of that in which you differed. And He it is who has made you successors in the land, and raised some of you above others by various grades, that He might try you by what He has given you. Surely, your Lord is quick to requite evil, and He is most surely the forgiving, the merciful.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Headlines: the Taliban capture the city of Faizabad in northern Afghanistan, bringing to 9 the number of provincial capitals seized by the militant group in less than a week. North Korea warns that its neighboring South will face a serious security crisis if it conducts joint military drills with the United States. And Ottawa slams as unjust a Chinese court verdict sentencing a Canadian businessman to 11 years in prison on spying charges. Hello and welcome everybody. Here in the Iranian capital, Tehran, this is World News. Our top story for this half hour, the Taliban have seized the 9th provincial capital in Afghanistan in less than a week as the group is pushing ahead with a rapid offensive to overrun the country. Local officials say the militants are now in control of Faizabad in the northeast following days of heavy fighting. The group seems to have tightened further their grip on northern Afghanistan with the capture of the capital of Badakhshan province. The gain comes hours after the militants took the capital cities of Baghlan province and the western border province of Farah. The Taliban have seized dozens of districts and border crossings in recent weeks and is now battling for several key cities. They've intensified their offensive following the withdrawal of U.S.-led foreign forces. Correspondent in Kabul, Amin Alami, says Faizabad fell into the hands of the Taliban after a large-scale attack on the city.
Over 900 Taliban militants, including some foreign nationals, had conducted a large-scale attack from four directions on the city of Faizabad. As a result, and as these military commanders there say, Afghan military forces have retreated and they are fighting still against the Taliban militants who are following Afghan security forces very close to Faizabad airport. In the meantime, the rest of areas in northern Afghanistan and northeast of Afghanistan, also the scene of collapse of big cities into the hands of Taliban. For instance, Shebirghan, the capital city of Juzjan province, is under the control of Taliban. After that, the Taliban captured Talikhan, the capital of northeastern Tahar province, and then Aibak city, the capital of Samangan province, came under the control of Taliban militants. And currently, fierce fightings are underway between both sides. I mean, Afghan security forces backed by local armed fronts and Taliban militants in the suburbs and inside some parts of the city of Pule Khumri, the capital city of Baghlan province. That is another northern province that connects northern Afghanistan to the Afghan capital Kabul via Parwan province.
Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi says foreign intervention in the region is a source of tensions and poses threats. In a meeting with Iraqi Foreign Minister Fuad Hussein, Raisi said regional cooperation is a prerequisite for lasting security and peace. The Iranian president also thanked Hussein for Baghdad's invitation of Iran to a regional summit planned for later this month. The Iraqi foreign minister, for his part, said lasting security can only be established in the region with the help of both Tehran and Baghdad. Iran has once again rejected the U.S. and U.K. allegations that the Islamic Republic was behind a recent attack on an Israeli-managed oil tanker off Oman. This after Washington and its allies, including Israel, renewed their accusation against Tehran during a U.N. Security Council meeting on Monday. We have more in this report.
Iran has once again denied having any link to the recent attack on an Israeli-managed oil tanker off Oman. Iran's deputy permanent representative to the UN, Zahra Ershadi, dismissed the accusations as politically motivated, saying there is no verifiable and conclusive evidence to substantiate the claim. Ershadi also urged the council to avoid being trapped by the fabrications of the Israeli regime, which as usual are blindly supported by certain Western countries. The Iranian diplomat responded to renewed accusations by the U.S. and its allies during Security Council meeting. During the virtual session, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken even vowed to punish Iran for the alleged attack. Iran has repeatedly rejected the accusations, warning that it will not hesitate to give a crushing response to any threat against its national security. Chief Commander of the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, Major General Hossein Salami, also warned Israel not to shorten its life by making a wrong and aggressive move. The Secretary of Iran's Supreme National Security Council said that Iran is carefully monitoring the suspicious moves by the U.S., the U.K., and Israel in the region.
Such moves are made to create chaos and confusion among countries in the Persian Gulf area. Tehran is ready to neutralize any plot to destabilize the region.
Following the ship incident, resistance sources told a media outlet that the attack was in retaliation for a recent deadly Israeli airstrikes on a Syrian airport. But Washington and London have thrown their weight behind Israel in its blame game against Iran while turning a blind eye to Israel's own hostile acts in the region. According to a report by Wall Street Journal, over a dozen of Iranian vessels had fallen victim to the Israeli attacks, some of which openly claimed by the regime. It seems that the West is trying to shift the international attention from Israel's frequent deadly attacks on the Gaza Strip and Syria, as well as its atrocities in the occupied territories. Such a stance will simply embolden Tel Aviv to push ahead with its crimes with impunity. Nonetheless, the ongoing plot against Iran is just exposing the weakness of a regime the U.S. and its Western allies had created in the occupied Palestine. The attack on an Israeli-managed ship and Israel's defeat in its war on Gaza at the hands of resistance groups spotlight the regime's weakness. This also shows the era of hit and run for Israel has come to an end.
North Korea says the South and the United States are risking, quote, a huge security crisis by choosing to escalate tensions. State media cited a top Workers' Party official saying that Seoul and Washington have responded to Pyongyang's goodwill with hostile acts. The statement comes a day after Pyongyang slammed Seoul for going ahead with its annual military exercises with the U.S., even after the North agreed to restore inter-Korean hotlines in late July. On Tuesday, North Korea stopped answering routine calls on the hotlines. The United States has more than 28,000 troops in South Korea. Pyongyang has always criticized Washington-Seoul joint military drills and viewed them as a threat. Our Seoul correspondent Jennifer Chang tells us more about the recent escalation of tensions between North and South Koreas.
Just 2 weeks after the two Koreas restored their severed hotlines, which were severed about a year ago, the South is already conducting nuclear war exercises with the U.S., according to the North, and they have to be able to rapidly respond to that. So they state that even though these nuclear war exercises are tabletop exercises right now, which are only computer simulated drills, that they are demanding that that is not enough, that the U.S. has to pull out all of its troops from ally South Korea and all of its military hardware. So now that leaves the South in a position where they have got to watch what's going on, and they are extremely concerned. The South Koreans, not all of them, but most of them, favor more engagement with North Korea, more willingness to compromise with the North. So I am sure that these moves by the Moon Jae-in administration to try to placate the U.S. by holding these tabletop exercises so soon after the hotlines were restored are not being received very well here in South Korea.
South Korea reports a record number of over 2,200 daily COVID-19 cases, the highest since the pandemic started last January.
With the recent spread of the more transmissible Delta variant virus, the number of confirmed cases is increasing, showing mass infection cases from workplaces, indoor sport facilities, churches, and nursing hospitals. Along with that, the rate of investigating the path of infection is also rising, which means silent spreaders within communities is increasing.
Health Minister Kwon Dok-chol says infections have increased due to the spread of the more transmissible Delta variant and a rise in domestic travel over summer. He urged people who return from holidays to voluntarily get tested before going back to work. South Korean health officials have so far registered more than 216,000 cases with over 2,100 deaths. Some 42% of the country's 52 million population have received at least one dose of the vaccine, while the government's target is to increase the number to 70% by September. Australian authorities have extended a lockdown in Melbourne for another 7 days after failing to curb the latest COVID-19 outbreak. 5 million residents of Australia's second largest city will remain under stay-at-home orders until August 19th. That's mainly due to the emergence of a fresh outbreak of the highly infectious Delta variant. Melbourne has been under lockdown for 6 weeks. Sydney is also in its seventh week of lockdown, putting more than 5 million people under stay-at-home orders. Australia's total coronavirus cases have exceeded 37,000, while the death toll stands at over 940. A court in China sentenced a Canadian businessman to 11 years in jail on charges of spying. A statement from a court in Dandong said the businessman illegally provided state secrets to other countries. Michael Spavor was detained in 2018, days after Canada detained telecoms giant Huawei chief financial officer Meng Wanzhou on a U.S. extradition request. Spavor's verdict comes a week after fresh hearings in the Meng case began in Vancouver as her lawyers fight to prevent her extradition to the U.S. On Tuesday, another Chinese court rejected an appeal by a Canadian who was sentenced to death for drug smuggling. Ottawa has condemned the verdicts, calling them politically motivated and unjust. In the U.S., embattled New York Governor Andrew Cuomo has announced his resignation amid sexual harassment allegations against him. In a televised address, Cuomo said he accepted full responsibility and apologized to any woman he said may have been offended by his actions. He, however, defended his conduct and denied sexual harassment allegations, adding that he didn't realize the extent to which the line had been redrawn. Cuomo said his resignation would take effect in 14 days. Last week, a report by the New York Attorney General's office found that Cuomo engaged in sexual harassment of 11 women. With Cuomo leaving office, Lieutenant Governor Kathy Hochul will become New York State's first female governor. While the United States has hailed Egypt as a constructive defense partner as Washington considers new military aid to Cairo, at a Senate hearing, State Department and Pentagon officials defended security assistance to Egypt as a critical tool for the Arab country to address its security concerns. U.S. President Joe Biden had pledged no more, quote, blank checks to Cairo due to brutal crackdown on critics. But Washington is considering whether to release $300 million in military aid that Congress has linked to human rights standards. Human rights groups have been urging Biden to exert pressure on Cairo by cutting military aid. The U.S. has been sending $1.3 billion in annual security aid to Egypt. Forest fires in Algeria have killed 42 people, including 25 soldiers who were deployed to help put out the inferno. The defense ministry said more soldiers had been badly injured with burns. Dozens of fires have been ravaging forests 100 kilometers east of the capital, Algiers, and the Kabyle region, where there are some difficult-to-access villages. Authorities said the simultaneous outbreak of many fires in the same location suggests that arsonists were behind igniting the flames. Last week, a European Union atmosphere monitor said the Mediterranean has become a wildfire hotspot as massive blazes engulfed forests in Turkey and Greece, aided by heat waves. The United Nations has released a harrowing assessment of the current climate conditions. It has warned of devastating impacts of global warming in the decades to come. Politicians and activists have called the report a wake-up call to change our ways and save Mother Earth.
the wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States and Canada, the unprecedented and deadly floods in Western Europe, the soaring temperatures across the world, and severe droughts elsewhere. These are all harbingers of a devastating climate crisis that is to come. The United Nations released its most comprehensive report on climate change yet on Monday. In the document, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, IPCC, said humans are to blame for the strange and tragic natural catastrophes the world is witnessing. The definite tone marked a contrast from the language used in previous reports, which had said industrial activity was extremely likely to blame. In a statement, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres called the report a code red for humanity. The report was published less than 3 months before the United Nations Climate Change Conference 2021, which will be hosted by Scotland. IPCC findings are expected to feature prominently in the discussions. The UN Climate Panel, IPCC, comprises thousands of scientists across 195 countries who compile peer-reviewed research articles about global warming into a report. This year's report was written by over 230 authors who have reviewed some 14,000 research papers.
Well, the report paints a stark picture of what the world would look like unless it cuts carbon emissions. The 2015 Paris Climate Accord set the target of limiting global warming to below 2 degrees Celsius compared to pre-industrial levels. But as of December 2020, not a single country was on course to meet that target. In that case, is there any hope to save the environment and stave off a climate disaster?
The IPCC report warns that even in the case of the sharpest cuts in emission, the world might not be able to maintain the global warming of 1.5 degrees Celsius target set by the Paris Accord, adding that without immediate steep cuts, the average temperatures will soar past 2 degrees Celsius by the end of the century. Moreover, according to the report, even if the world manages to cap global warming at the 1.5 degrees Celsius target, extreme weather conditions will continue to become more common and intense. A rise in sea levels also seems inevitable, as the report says even with the most severe cuts in carbon emissions, the melting of polar ice will elevate sea levels for hundreds or even thousands of years. All is not lost, however, as the IPCC suggests there is still time to prevent the worst-case scenario. The UN panel says the world has about a decade to decrease the rate at which it pumps carbon into the atmosphere before it's too late. Activists and politicians reacted to the findings with alarm. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson called the IPCC report a wake-up call, while US President Joe Biden called for action to fight climate change. Many have so far shrugged off climate warnings and believe the concept of global warming and climate change to be a hoax. But now that there are more signs of climate change than ever before, will there be a universal consensus and will to counter the devastating impact we're exerting on the planet?
And that brings us to an end here on this edition of World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
Supplication on Wednesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who appointed the night to be a garment, and sleep for a rest, and day he appointed for a rising. To thee belongs praise, for thou roused me from my sleep. And hadst thou willed, thou wouldst have made it everlasting, an everlasting praise that will never be cut off, and whose number the creatures will never count. O Allah, to thee belongs praise, for thou created, then proportioned, and ordained and decreed, and gave death and bestowed life, and made sick and healed, and made well and afflicted, and sat upon the throne and encompassed the kingdom. I supplicate thee with the supplication of one whose mediation is weak, whose stratagems have been cut off, whose term has drawn near, whose expectation from this world has shrunk, whose neediness for thy mercy has intensified, whose remorse for his neglect has become great, whose slips and stumbles have become many, and whose repentance is devoted sincerely to thy face. So bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and his household, the good, the pure. And provide me with the intercessions of Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, and deprive me not of his companionship. Surely thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, decree for me on Wednesday four things. Induce me to be strong in obedience to thee, to be joyful in worshipping thee, to be desirous of thy reward, and to abstain from that which would make incumbent upon me thy painful punishment. Thou art gentle to whom thou wilt.
Muharram Special. In the name of God, Salam and welcome to the program. The name and memory of Imam Hussein, peace upon him, is alive in the hearts of the faithful and freedom seekers after the lapse of centuries. Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, says on his grandson, "Indeed, Hussein is the beacon of guidance and the ark of salvation." Yes, the ark of Hussein is sailing throughout the history of mankind, calling on them, give up aimlessness and corruption, and learn the way of worship of God to reach the coast of dignity and eternal happiness. Imam Hussein, peace upon him, says, "O people, God created the servants to know him in order to worship him and become needless of the worship of anything other than him. Imam Hussein was plunged in monotheism to the extent that every minute aspect of his life manifested this. His words in Mecca and Mena on the course toward Karbala and during the great event of Ashura were all based on monotheism. He says, a group of servants worships God because of their desire for paradise. This is the worship of tradesmen. Another group worships God out of fearing him. This is the worship of slaves. And a group worships God as they find him worthy of worship. This is the worship of free-spirited people. Hussein is the Lord of the free in the world. His famous supplication on the day of Arafah is a rich source of monotheism. In part of the supplication, he says, my God, you are the nearest one to be called, and the fastest to answer, and the noblest to pardon, and the vastest to grant, and the most hearing to ask for. O the merciful of the world and the hereafter, and the compassionate of the both. There is no one to be called like you, and to no one to be wished like you. I called you, and you answered me. I asked from you, and you granted me, and I came to you zealously, and you had mercy on me. I trusted in you, and you saved me. And I took refuge in you, and you sufficed me. Imam Hussein, peace upon him, is so great that the Prophet of Islam said on him, surely Hussein is one of the gates of paradise. The fact that Imam Hussein endured the hardest and bitterest calamities on the day of Ashura without the least doubt and anxiety is because of his inward attention to God. Like his entire life, Hussein was in full remembrance of God on the day of Ashura. He kept calling the enemies to the worship of God as he knew that Yazid was a libertine and corrupt leader and was not worthy of ruling the Islamic Ummah. But when Hussein realized that the hordes of Yazid were blind and deaf towards the truth, he told them, Satan has dominated you and taken away God's remembrance from your hearts. Shame on you and your wolves. We belong to God, and to Him do we return. Another beautiful aspect of Imam Hussein was his dignity and free spirit. This stemmed from his monotheistic outlook. As he was in full bond with the source of creation, he worshipped only him and would never worship others in humility. He told those who called on him for an oath of allegiance with Yazid, don't you see that the truth is not practiced and the falsehood is not prevented? In such conditions, indeed, a faithful should wish death and meeting God. Thus, I do not see death except salvation and life with oppressors like hardship. Imam Hussein, peace upon him, didn't surrender to the enemy even during the hardest conditions of the battle. He didn't show the least softness that would imply humility. The Epic of Ashura was the picture of freedom, dignity, manliness, and pride. He told the group of people who prevented him from going to Karbala, "You tell me not to go, but I will go. You say that I will be killed. Is the death of a chivalrous man a scandal? Death is scandalous when the goal of man is base and he seeks chairmanship. But it is nor scandalous for the one who is killed to exalt the word of truth and in the way of truth as he marches in the way of the righteous and the good servants of God." Elsewhere, Imam Hussein says, "Death with dignity is better than life with humility."
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Ministry.
The explosion that shook our city of Beirut a year ago was something we have never seen in any Hollywood movie. I don't know of it if it's possible to make such a scene in even an animated movie either. I give only one piece of information to explain the horror of the incident. The quivering of this explosion was a 3.5 on the Richter scale. 218 people were killed in the blast of Beirut, a few of whom were on ground zero at the time of the explosion were never found. More than 7,000 were injured, and more than 300,000 people became instantly homeless. People from around the world expressed their sorrow at the suddenness of the incident, but the first punch was thrown by former U.S. President Donald Trump. In a briefing at the White House shortly after the incident, he claimed that the explosion was a massive bomb attack. This raised a whole lot of questions for everyone as to who might have done it, how, and most importantly, why. On the other hand, the Lebanese government claimed since the beginning of the incident that more than 2,700 tons of ammonium nitrate were stored in the warehouse where the incident took place at the seaport. This made every one of us wonder why this huge amount of ammonium has been stored in a densely populated area since 2014. The fact so far is that the ammonium was recovered from a ship brought in illegally and stored in a warehouse at the seaport since 2014, and a whole lot of officials knew about it, including heads of state, prime ministers, and even, or rather mainly, the commander-in-chief of the Lebanese armed forces. The atrocity encapsulated everything that is rotten about Lebanon's governing system. The rampant corruption, the incompetent inaction, a system held hostage by a foreign power whose potence to be Lebanese defenders shattered this nation many times over. And last but not least, our eternal enemy, Israel, that benefited from every atrocity that had ever fallen upon my people, whether they had a hand in it or not. The lesson of the August 4 atrocity is that accepting that the U.S.-French imposed regime means accepting leaders who think nothing of murdering their own citizens. If we allow Lebanon to continue fragmenting, it opens the door to catastrophes of an infinitely greater magnitude than the fourth explosion. This disaster must be our wake-up call for inaugurating a new Lebanon. There's no salvation for a system that is rotten to the core, pushed by Western colonial powers. Our salvation is through collectively banishing those who colluded in Lebanon's downfall and who remain wedded to a medieval and inherently corrupt sectarian system. About 100 years ago, in 1923, Gibran wrote in The Prophet, "You need to know the secret of death. How can you know the secret if you do not know life?" But today, Gibran's Beirut does not know the secret of death as we struggle to decipher the meaning of our lives on this beautiful yet battered piece of land. Welcome to the Middle East Stream. I'm Marwa Osman. A year after the explosion that rocked Beirut on August 4th, 2020, killing 218 people, injuring more than 7,000, and devastating much of the city, the Lebanese investigation into the blast has yielded no credible results. Families of the victims, some of whom are calling for an international investigation, are sadly being beaten by riot police a year after the tragedy for simply demanding the truth about what killed their kids, their mothers, their fathers, their loved ones. A year after the explosion, none of the victims' families in Lebanon have been asked to give witness statements, nor have they received any form of official apology or even been contacted by Lebanese authorities. Families of the victims and every Lebanese citizen wants answers to their many questions. They want to know why the ammonium nitrate was in the port, who ordered it, and what's happened to the rest of it since just 750 tons out of the 2,750 stored there reportedly exploded. Just imagine what would have happened to Beirut and its greater surrounding areas had the 2,750 tons exploded. I can't imagine. We want to know if there were other explosives kept in that port and how the fire that triggered the explosion was started, and whether it was really just a fire or was it an act of terrorism. To discuss this issue with us from Beirut is member of the Lebanese Parliament, Dr. Ibrahim Moussaoui from the Loyalty to the Resistance Bloc Hezbollah. Thank you very much, Dr. Moussaoui, for being with us. A year on after the largest non-nuclear explosion in history, how do you set the scene post-blast, pandemic-ridden, financially beaten Lebanon?
Well, this is, first of all, thank you for having me on the show. What we're about actually to talk about now, we're talking about one of the worst catastrophes ever. We're talking here about a disaster that was man-made. It's whether it's negligence, whether it's in purpose, whatever the reason is. All of this time that has passed, we're about like two days from now, and we're going to have the first anniversary for this tragedy that happened in Lebanon. We've been waiting and we continue to wait for the judiciary to come out and to give the victims some tribute, to give their families some answers for the very important questions about what happened. We're not telling them to tell us about the secret issues, the secret side of the investigation. We know very well and we believe in the secrecy of the investigation. It should be kept. It should be classified for one reason or another, because we wanted justice. Justice is what we seek. But still now there are things that can be told to the people, to the public opinion, to all the Lebanese parties, to all the Lebanese factions, to the international community. And if you know, and we know that for a fact, that the Secretary General of Hezbollah, Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, has come two times and he has sought this. He has said that we want the judiciary to come and tell us, the one who is taking the responsibility of the investigation, to come and tell us about the general lines of what happened, general lines of how did this explosion happen. Because you know very well that Hezbollah is being accused by certain parties, and they are investing.
We will talk about that extensively, but Dr. Moussaoui, 218 people died in the Beirut explosion, yet the survivors have been abandoned. for slow, torturous deaths or maybe sickness from hunger, from poverty, from lack of medicine, and from the political turmoil that is possibly yet to come to the country. What has Hezbollah done so far within its jurisdiction as part of the government and as part of the Lebanese parliament as well to ensure justice is to be served at least to the survivors?
Actually, one very important issue, we are not, there is a government and there is a statesmanship. There is a state that should handle the whole matter. You are exactly right. We are part of the government. We are part of the parliament, and we should be responsible one way or another in order to make sure, ensure that justice is going to take its place. To tell you the truth, I am in the Committee of Justice and Administration in the Lebanese parliament, and we have gone through this issue deeply. We have brought opinions, legal opinions from judges, from authorities, some people who have authority over such issues, and they themselves said when we got this appeal from the judiciary that they want the parliamentarians or some MPs who were ministers at the time to come and appear before the court, we have tried as much as we can in order to take a legal decision. No legal conclusion has come to us that the parliament has any evidence or has any premises where they can build upon to present those to the judiciary. That's why the Lebanese parliament has taken the initiative to direct accusations, and in order to later on present a committee that is going to be composed of eight judges from the Lebanese judiciary, seven MPs from the Lebanese parliament, and they are going to go into deep investigation for those who are accused of negligence or of whatever.
Why did it take so much time? It's been a year.
Yeah, it's been a year because, to tell you the truth, there has been a problem. You know what happened? There was one judge, and then he was replaced by another,
yes.
And they were like looking into the different evidences.
Definitely.
Or whatever.
Why?
That
brings
are
us
there.
To summarizing what's happening right now against Hezbollah, to be specific. Now, the atrocity summarized everything that is rotten about Lebanon's governing system, the corruption, the incompetent inaction, and the politicized judiciary system, which explains why it went to one judge and then to the other. Yet a large group of NGOs that were born directly after that explosion, who are funded by Western powers, are propagating that Hezbollah is behind the blast and that the regime is being held, and I quote, hostage by Hezbollah. Could you please tell us in what sectors are you guys holding the Lebanese regime hostage, if you don't mind me asking?
This is a joke, but
it is.
No one likes such jokes, actually. When we talk about political things, when we talk about a country that is engulfed in such a huge problems, those people who are doing this, they are trying to mislead the public. They are trying to mislead the whole people in Lebanon and outside, because they are actually covering the face of the true criminal, and they are trying to pinpoint to others who are not responsible. Actually, we have nothing whatsoever to do with what happened. We know this is a political agenda that has been trying to be put into effect through military actions, military operations, military aggressions. We remember this. I mean, this is for all of the public. We should understand that they are trying to get rid of the resistance one way or another. They started and continued this kind of military aggressions by Israel. It didn't work. Then they have the Takfiri groups. It didn't work. Then they came to this issue.
And this is the second time a political accusation has been made against Hezbollah. And I want to talk more about this, Dr. Ibrahim, but we want to go to the second segment where we dive in into the accusations and what can be done to bring justice to people. Please stay with us. Knowing the truth will not bring our victims back. It will not heal out my youngest child, who still jumps in fear anytime there is a thunderstorm, although her face healed. And she now laughs about it, and she says it's a clown nose once she sees it in photographs. She stayed with the clown nose for weeks, and now she calls it the Big Bang. And when Lebanon's ruling elite pay for what they did, maybe we can have a change here in Lebanon and we can live it in a normal country. Lebanese authorities initially promised a swift investigation into the blast, vowing to deliver results within 5 days. Yes, 5 days. But over the past 12 months, the investigation into the biggest crime in Lebanon's history has been marked by little more than obstruction, evasion, and delay. Lebanon running out of political and economic chances in this following report.
On August 4th, 2020, a devastating blast in a warehouse destroyed much of the center of the Lebanese capital, Beirut. Many neighborhoods were destroyed. Downtown Beirut looked like a war zone. Thousands were injured and some 218 people tragically lost their lives on that day and the days that followed. For many, their poverty and livelihoods were literally blown away. The effects of those explosions are still reverberating 1 year later. The country is striving to find a path to emerge from a tragedy that has touched every single person. The destructive fallout of August 4th intensified suffering in Lebanon, which was already reeling from civil unrest, economic and financial hardship, increasing poverty and unemployment, compounded by political deadlock and a soaring number of COVID-19 cases. A year on from this tragedy, there is deepening hardships and mounting frustration. It is clear that the situation of ordinary people in Lebanon is worsening by the day. Currently, the UN estimates that more than 1 million Lebanese out of a population of almost 8 million, including more than 2 million refugees and migrants, need relief assistance to cover their basic needs, including access to food, health, education, and water. Lebanon, which not so long ago was a high middle-income country, is now facing probably the worst financial and economic crisis in its modern history. Over half of its population is living in poverty. It is perhaps not surprising that many people have lost trust in their leaders and institutions. It is regretful that Lebanon's leaders have been unable to reach agreement on the formation of a new government in the past 12 months, which has delayed urgently needed structural reforms to address the country's numerous challenges. This is a critical moment in Lebanon's history. The combined magnitude, depth, and multidimensionality of the political, socioeconomic, and humanitarian crisis facing Lebanon is unprecedented and presents an increasingly challenging landscape for people who still believe that change is possible. Much of the devastation from the blast is still visible. The port resembles a bomb site, and many buildings have been left in a state of collapse. Major questions remain unanswered, including why such a large shipment of ammonium nitrate, a highly explosive chemical used in bombs and fertilizer, was left stored in the middle of a crowded city for years after unloading in 2014. The immunity enjoyed by senior officials has raised suspicions among some families that there may never be accountability. But ultimately, the responsibility for avoiding the total collapse of Lebanon lies primarily in the hands of its leaders, who so far have shown no intention to truly relieve the suffering of the Lebanese population.
Now we continue with member of the Lebanese parliament, Dr. Ibrahim Moussaoui from the Loyalty to the Resistance bloc, Hezbollah. Thanks again, Dr. Ibrahim. Now, days ago, it was published in the media by Reuters, to be specific, that the FBI concluded after the blast that the amount of ammonium nitrate that blew up in Beirut port last year was 1/5 of the shipment unloaded there in 2014, adding to suspicions that much of the cargo has actually gone missing. Now, legally speaking, who is responsible for the whereabouts of such a shipment, and where on earth is the remaining part of the ammonium nitrate?
Well, this is a very excellent question. Actually, first, I mean, this tragic event that happened, again, now we are 2 days from now, it will be the first anniversary. The answers are still being sought from the state, from the official side, from the judiciary. If you want exactly who's responsible, here we're talking about who's responsible for the port, for the Beirut port, for the cargo that are there. It's well known, officially, it's the Lebanese army. The Lebanese army is the one who is responsible for the cargo. It's not the general security, mm-hmm. because I mean, it's only responsible for the individuals, not for the cargo or for the goods or whatever. The other one, it's the judiciary, army, because and I'm talking generally, this is in general. But if you go, when the judiciary, when this was reported to the judiciary, the judge, there's a judge who has taken a decision to confiscate this or to put it somewhere with all the reservations to be reserved, the official reservation on it. He is the one responsible, actually, and this has been said, actually, that when it is in the hands of the judiciary, because of the principle of the separation of powers, no one has the right to go and interfere in the work and the action and the function of the judiciary. So here we're talking about the judiciary system that is responsible and the judge who has taken a decision to put them aside and to have investigation over them.
Why wasn't he brought in to at least ask him a couple of questions?
This is one of the problems, actually. Why we have always called for the, if you want, for the sovereignty of the and the sovereignty and the independence of judiciary in Lebanon, mm-hmm. and it has to do with the individuals themselves. To tell you, if you put the best system, if you write the best law, you need someone to put it into effect. Who do put it into effect? The people, the individuals. So when we talk about the individuals and the people, we are talking about judges. This judge who is responsible, he has not been summoned to be listened to or to hear him. There was no session of hearing. There was nothing. And actually, this is why the Lebanese parliament did not accept, actually, because you did not even do anything about this judge or other one responsible.
Well, this is what I want to ask you about. A probe into the port blast led by Judge Tariq Bitar has been hindered over the past month as requests sent to Parliament and to government, the one that you're talking about, to lift immunity and enable questioning of several top officials. These demands were either declined or they were stalled. Why was it stalled or declined? And what is Hezbollah's stance on this, given that
we did see
signatures of MPs, and we need just to understand why.
Well, to tell you, I'm because I am a member of Justice and Administration Committee, I put my signature also on this list, actually, in order to make a list of accusation against the accused or those who thought of people, mm-hmm. Ministers or whatever. Why did we do that? Because when we got this appeal from Judge Bitar, we sent him a message. We held a meeting. This is the legal way. This is the legal way to do it, actually. Mm-hmm. We went, we brought all of the parliamentary committees in the parliament. We're talking about the Administration and Justice Committee, and we are talking, when you talk about Administration and Justice Committee, all of the Lebanese parties are represented in this. They are presented, and they are represented there. Mm-hmm. So you're talking about all the parliamentary blocks, they were there. When we started to discuss it, and when we heard those who are accused, there was nothing in the appeal. If you want someone to come to you as a judiciary, you should have brought, I'm not talking about evidences, you should bring some premises, something significant to convince us to not lift, as they say, the immunity. It's not a matter of lifting the immunity. What we have in the parliament is that when we have high treason by the ministers or by the president of the republic, we have the right to form a parliamentary committee, or we have the right to make this accusation. Actually, the Judge Bitar himself did not support, he did not supply us with anything in order to put this into effect. And we sent him a message.
So how
asking,
come they asked to
lift the immunity? We sent him a message again, and we told him, if you have anything, when we discussed this on the legal side, and all the parliamentary blocks, they were there, and they all accepted what we said, actually.
And why was Hezbollah specifically targeted?
Because this is the important question. This tells you that this is the agenda. This is the agenda. This is what they wanted to do. We have been targeted because there is a hidden agenda to all of this. They want to accuse the party of different things because they want to mount the pressure from now till the coming elections, and they want to make this kind of wedge between the people and Hezbollah.
So it's purely a legal matter. But
it is,
Lebanon,
it is purely illegal. It's purely political.
No, I'm talking the lifting the immunity. It's a legal matter that needs evidence. That's why you did not allow.
Absolutely. I'll tell you what. You know what happened when the judge wanted? They put it into the media. You know,
mm-hmm.
instead of sending it to the accused, to the ministers, to the parliamentarians, whoever they are, they heard it from the news. And you know, this is the public
Which
opinion,
illegal.
As we say. This is a kind of propaganda, mm-hmm. public opinion. You are mobilizing the people against those persons.
So they
without
are changing
giving them the
from illegal into a political propaganda.
Exactly.
But Lebanon is at a very decisive
and we, and to tell you
now,
the truth, and to tell you the truth, we have asked the judge, please resend us anything that could allow us, and we are ready to make a meeting at any time in order to lift the immunity, as you said. Mm-hmm. But
well,
he didn't provide
so
us with anything tangible.
So it's now basically in the hands of Judge Bitar and what happens next. But Lebanon is at a decisive crossroad now with Najib Miqati being the new prime minister designate instead of Saad al-Hariri. And people are criticizing his name, especially that Miqati has a responsibility to uphold since he was prime minister when the ammonium nitrate entered the Beirut port. And he knows about that. What will Miqati be able to achieve here that Hariri was not? And what is your main concern as Hezbollah for the upcoming political and security reality in Lebanon? We have seen over the past couple of days a huge dive in security.
I'm not in a position to defend Prime Minister designate Miqati or to attack someone else. It's only that we have a way in order to come out of this problem. What is the way? The only way is to have to form a government. Now, who was nominated to this position? You know, when we talk about Lebanon, we talk about the priorities. We have a political system who come into a deadlock. We have a structural deficit. We have structural disorder in the political system itself. Now we are, as just like what you said, in a decisive, very sensitive, very crucial position on the economic level, in the political level, on every level. Now, Saad al-Hariri, who was not successful to form the cabinet, he named in the name of the Sunni majority. Let's accept that we live in a confessional system. He named Miqati to this position, and that's why we accepted this, and we have nominated him. We have named him. Why did we do that? Because this is the only way to try to make an attempt to come out of the mm-hmm. stalemate of the problem of the crisis.
So hopefully we look forward into forming a government soon enough to try and lift the country from the political and economic challenges.
We don't say that we don't have problems. We don't say we don't have problems. We don't say that there are no flaws or mistakes. But this is the way that would lead us out, and hopefully we can do it.
Inshallah. Thank you very much, Dr. Ibrahim Moussaoui, Lebanese Member of Parliament, part of the Loyalty to the Resistance Bloc, Hezbollah. Thank you very much for being with us. And thank you. Please stay tuned next week for more from the Middle East streams.
In the limelight.
The Dixie Fire became the second largest wildfire in state history on Sunday, August 8, after gobbling an additional 15,000 acres to sprawl across 489,287 total acres in four Northern California counties, CAL FIRE said. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Emma Talley, journalist. This article is published under the heading, Dixie Fire Now, Second Largest Wildfire in California History, and is sprawling across four counties. Stay tuned for more. The Dixie Fire became the second largest wildfire in state history on Sunday, August 8, after gobbling an additional 15,000 acres to sprawl across 489,287 total acres in four Northern California counties, Cal Fire said. Containment of the blaze on Sunday, August 8, remained unchanged at 21%. The huge fire burning across Plumas, Butte, Tama, and Lassen counties have destroyed 404 structures, including the historic gold rush town of Greenville, and damaged 27 others, a damage assessment finds. More than 5,000 firefighters were battling the blaze. The Dixie Fire has only reinforced officials' concerns that this season, with severe drought, extreme weather, and an abundance of dry fuels in the mix, could rival or exceed last year's record-shattering wildfire year. The already monstrous fire would have to more than double in size, however, on top of the state's largest ever wildfire, the August complex, which burned slightly over 1 million acres in 2020. The Dixie Fire ignited on July 13th, possibly sparked by a tree that fell on a Pacific Gas and Electric Company power line, the company said. Its equipment also may have ignited the smaller Fly Fire, which merged with the Dixie Fire overnight on July 24th. Cal Fire said it does not consider the Dixie Fire a fire complex, like the huge August LNUSCU and SZU fires caused by lightning sieges last year. According to the U.S. Forest Service, a fire complex is two or more individual incidents located in the same general area, which are assigned to a single incident commander or unified command. That makes Dixie the largest non-complex fire in California.